Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, South Africa moves to vaccinate 7 million cattle as a mass plan aims to save the livestock economy. Eskom turns the corner as a ratings upgrade signals a new phase of stability. King 5 raises the stakes as corporate governance enters a new era of transparency and artificial intelligence emerging as South Africa's potential entrepreneurial equalizer. It's Thursday, the 27th of November. South Africa, as I understand it, has taken one of its biggest agricultural policy decisions in decades. The Agriculture Minister, John Steenhuisen, says the entire national cattle herd, something around 7 million animals, will now be vaccinated against foot and mouth disease. Now, it's a bold response, I think, to a crisis that has crippled farmers, it's shut export markets and has shaken confidence in our biosecurity system. But obviously it raises enormous questions about capacity, about logistics, about cost and credibility. So let's put some of those questions to Wandile Sihlobo, Chief Economist at AgBiz. Wandile, you've called this, and welcome to you, a courageous policy step, but it's also an admission that South Africa surely has effectively lost control of foot and mouth disease through traditional containment measures.
Yeah, I think the traditional containment measures were experiencing, Jeremy, a lot of challenges for some time, because remember, this is not the first time we are experiencing this foot and mouth disease. We had one of the difficult periods in 2022-23, and right now it seemed to actually be getting at a very tough situation. It does not mean that all is lost, because we could continue on a vaccination path until we get ourselves at such a stage where we can be disease-free. And then at such a stage, then we can even stop vaccination. We have seen Brazil do the same. We have seen Argentina do the same. Mm. But it does indeed, to your point, signify that foot and mouth disease has become a crisis in some corners of South Africa.
7 million animals to vaccinate. What's a realistic timeline for full national coverage?
This is going to take some time, and it will also depend on what collaborations and the phasing strategy that will happen. My sense is that we will lean on the provincial structures that exist, farmer associations that exist, as well as, I would argue, and this is the point I'm yet to raise with the leadership, about making sure that the graduates and the young students that are on the vet side, they get involved in some of this process. My sense is it would probably take a year or and more than this. Because remember, Jeremy, we're not only vaccinating once. You probably need it to run for probably 3 years in order to vaccinate. Because in some vaccines, you vaccinate once a year. In some, you vaccinate even as much as three times a year, it depending on the potency of that vaccine. So the point is, it will take some time. It's difficult to give the exact time frame.
And while we wait for some kind of clarification, our export market still remains vulnerable in the interim.
Some remain vulnerable in the interim, and some, there will be some arrangements that South Africa will make. And I like the fact that you are raising the exports, because remember, in the beef industry, we earn around $300 million on exports. And of course, now we've been closed off in some countries because of the disease. But I think once we are able to have a common understanding with some markets that we are vaccinating, they may be able to accept the animals as we progress with the vaccination status. And I certainly believe and hope so, for those lucrative markets in the Far East, the Middle East, and Asia that have been one of our growing area for exports.
Let me ask you a capacity question, technical, financial, operational, just in terms of the production of vaccines at the scale required. Does it exist, or are we risking another state capacity failure?
I think as South Africa, we are now well awake to the challenges of corruption that may erupt. At least that's what I would hope. So at this time around, we don't have our active vaccine that we can put into the market instantly. We will be importing to a range of countries. It may be Turkey, maybe Botswana, and a couple of others. That's the technicalities that we'll be getting into. But as that is ongoing, there will also be work to revive the domestic capacity, which is at the Agricultural Research Council and at OBP, because we once had these capabilities, but they fell into the hands of the state capture, which is when we lost this capacity. But now it's about how do we revive it. Another point that, Jeremy, I'm yet to raise with the leadership at the Department of Agriculture is a need for us to involve private sector more, not just in conversation, but also the private labs that can produce to be able to be involved in this discussion so that they can be able to increase the production and help us with the capacity that we need.
If private sector labs that are brought in, are they not going to face regulatory, institutional, even political barriers?
The regulatory issue is the one that currently blocks some of them now, because it's not so much the scientific capabilities on some, at least that I've been able to go and talk to and see their capabilities. This then it means that on the regulatory side, there is some tweaking that will be necessary. But of course, Jeremy, on this, as you will appreciate, and as you rightly framed it in your intro, it's one of the biggest policy steps that we are taking. So learning by doing and adjustments in this process is something that I think will actually be the reality of the day.
And Wandile, how much will vaccinating the national herd cost?
I am hesitant on putting this figure, but it will be on the billions. But I'm hesitant to give you the tentative figure that we are working with.
So let me come at it from another angle. Who's paying then? Is it farmers, the state, or exporters? And does the industry broadly have the money right now?
I think before the announcement, there was some assessment of where the financial situation would look like. And of course, given that some of this is public good, so the government will be doing its share. And upon assessment of those capabilities, there are some of the private sector entities, feedlotters and others, that may perhaps maybe have to be able to do something on their own and buy some of the vaccine. And certainly there are some that have already contributed to some of those efforts. But Jeremy, it's a moving target. There will be a lot of evaluating the pace and the availability of vaccines on various suppliers. And I think the payment arrangement and all of those things will become clearer at that time, which is why, in part, I am hesitant on both of giving you a figure that we are working with, as well as certainty just about how the logistics of this will go. But there is a lot of thinking that has gone through it and is continuously evolving.
And one hopes that proper risk management has been applied ahead of the decision or the announcement, because there are surely unintended consequences, maybe counterfeit vaccines, black market behavior, or even possibly an uneven rollout that leaves pockets of vulnerability within the national herd.
I think the benefit that we have as South Africa is also the fact that we are a country whose agricultural sector has leaned on scientific advancement for quite some time. The productivity that we currently enjoy, to have a sector that is more than double what we had in 1994, speaks to those scientific capabilities. This is all to say then, embarking on issues of this scale in science, while it looks daunting when one looks into it, but I think South Africa does have the capabilities to be able to ensure that we utilize the right vaccines. Of course, I'm not saying everything will be perfect. Mm. There may be some challenges here and there, but I think South Africa is well prepared. As to the assessment of the risks, I am confident that the work that the scientific community has done will be able to carry us through. And I will say this, Jeremy, I had calls with the number of major feedlots in South Africa, and they welcome this decision. And they also have their vets, and there are many people that will be able to assist, as per leaving no one behind and ensuring that there's small farmers in certain areas are not left aside. I think there's an incentive for everyone to ensure that if you vaccinate everyone, because if you leave others, then you are creating a risk for yourself in the system. So there is a financial incentive to ensure that you reach every corner.
Wandile Sihlobo is AgBiz's chief economist. Thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at midday.
Now, Eskom, you might have read, has just earned an upgrade from S&P. It's its first real vote of confidence in years on the back of better generation performance, tighter governance, and the first profit in almost a decade. But I think it's fair to say that behind the headlines do lie tougher questions about whether the recovery is real, sustainable, and financially credible. I'm in conversation now with Eskom's Chief Financial Officer, Caleb Kassim. A very warm welcome. The first profit in 8 years. Let's start with this. How much comes from real operational gain versus once-offs or support measures?
I think, firstly, as a once-off, we did get this SARS rebate of 9 billion. So if you remove that, you will still see that the underlying contribution and your EBITDA almost doubled year on year. And that's linked to, on the back of the better performance, we increased our sales volumes, agree off a low base by 3.5%, and that has contributed to contributions. But I think, secondly, Jeremy, obviously with the debt relief we've got from government, we've seen our finance costs reduce significantly over the last 2 years. So I think a combination of production costs coming down, the diesel cost dropped quite a bit, you know, from a high of some 36 billion to 18 billion, an 18 billion increase. And importantly, we're projecting for March 26 that 18 billion to drop to about 8.5 billion. So again, looking forward, we see this now real savings coming through in the better production and lower costs.
Caleb, can I ask you then what your debt to EBITDA outlook is for the next 3 years going forward? And I'm wondering if this S&P upgrade would materially change it.
No, so at the moment, you know, at a high, Jeremy, that was sitting at about 14 times. We probably around 5 times. We wanted to come to 4 times. And that's where we see it being sustainable, you know, with a large industrial and long-term assets. So, and as the CFO and directing the finances, we believe we should be managing debt on the balance sheet of 300 billion. At a peak, it was close to 500 billion. And that's what we believe is sustainable. So that gives us confidence in terms of the rating that S&P has put out.
But if you strip out guarantees and equity injections, are you confident in saying that Eskom is truly cash flow positive and self-funding just yet?
So definitely in the medium term, obviously with the debt relief, we don't see ourselves borrowing in the next 18 months. Our biggest problem, and we've raised this continuously, we have to address the municipal debt. We currently are not collecting about 20 billion per annum. That's clearly unsustainable. And we know government and in the MTBPS, those clear statements from Minister of Finance, Minister of Electricity, we need to resolve that. If we do that, Jeremy, I'm confident then we can stand on our own feet. We don't have to go back to the fiscus for further bailouts.
The problem, of course, is how to resolve that. As you rightly say, municipal arrears remain a major risk. At what point then, Caleb, do non-payments push Eskom back into negative cash flow?
At the moment, right, we don't see negative cash flow, as I said, in the next 2 years. But if this rate continues, we said, you know, in about 3 to 4 years' time, that currently there was 100, and this is metros and municipalities, 105 billion. It'll go to a point where, Jeremy, it outstrips and it nullifies the benefits of the 230 billion debt relief. So it's not only about Eskom and electricity, it's about water and all the other services. It has to be resolved. Because at the end of the day, we know as Eskom, we can't shut off an entire municipality because it's paying customers behind it, and the economic implications. We've seen the devastation that load shedding has created to the economy. So we have to find a solution and work together with government, SALGA, COCTA, National Treasury, and get the municipalities to perform.
The problem is it doesn't seem as if you're making enough progress on that front.
So I think, you know, from where I'm sitting, if I see every portfolio committee, it's been discussed. We've had in the last 2 weeks, I think, three sessions with the different portfolio committees. And now that Minister of Finance says fully supported, we need to now embed this distribution agency agreement. And yeah, it's a partnership. We work with the municipalities, help them to deal with their credit control, help them to deal with their billing systems, collections, etc. So to increase the payment levels, we agree, you'll never get to 100%. Mm. But from current levels, and it varies across municipalities, let's increase that to a certain level where we collect more and they also benefit. Caleb, it has to be solved, Jeremy.
And you're confident that that's going to happen, and you're going to have to ratchet up the pressure in the next 12 to 18 months, though?
We have to, and we know as Eskom we can't do it alone. So if everyone, as for SA Inc., are not working together, we have then a problem that's not going to go away. And then it leaves us at a situation where if worse comes to worse, we will have no other choice but to go back via the shareholder back to Minister of Finance and Duncan, and we don't want that to happen.
Can I ask you about crime and corruption and whether you're able to tell me what the latest quantified loss is and how much of that is fallen under the reform plan that you're currently implementing?
So to quantify it is very difficult, but what I can say, if we look at the number of incidences and we look specifically at the power stations, the fact that they are performing, we're not getting any reports or significant reports around sabotage. We see stations, you know, are operating. You know, on average, we're finding ourselves where in the last 2 months, we had anything between 4,000 to 7,000 megawatts of spare capacity. So I use that as a barometer to see that we're dealing with fraud and corruption at the significant levels. There are definitely elements that are still occurring, dealing with law enforcement. But to quantify it, it's very difficult. And this is excluding this online vending system and the illegal tokens, because we're separately dealing with that in a separate project.
Caleb, let me finish with this. CapEx is still tight. I wonder whether you're under-investing in maintenance and maybe risking long-term plant health simply to protect the short-term numbers that we've been discussing?
No, so we've learned the hard lesson, Jeremy. The worst thing you do is cut maintenance and cut CapEx. So with the debt relief, I've been able, together with the board, release 3 years maintenance costs as well as CapEx to order long lead spares. So that, and if you look at our maintenance numbers, they've actually gone up and we've seen the increase in our CapEx, and that trend will continue. We need these assets to operate to the end of the economic life to generate the revenue. So that is one item we don't look to cut, but it must be done efficiently.
Caleb Kasim is Eskom's Chief Financial Officer. Caleb, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday. For all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa's governance landscape has been shaken up. The new King 5 report is the biggest overhaul in more than a decade, and it ends the era of vague promises and box-ticking. Companies, as I understand it, will now have to prove their governance, disclose their weaknesses, and face public scrutiny like never before. With simplified principles, double materiality, and even AI oversight, this is a fundamental reset for corporate accountability. Well, let's discuss this in a little more detail. I'm in conversation now with advocate Annemarie van der Merwe, Executive Chair of Fluid Rock Governance Group and one of the contributors to King 5. Advocate, a very warm welcome to you. King 5 demands proof, not promises. So let's start with this. Is this effectively an admission that South African boards have been hiding behind voluntary governance for years?
I think what it really is to try and get accessibility and transparency into the marketplace. I do think there has been quite a bit of window dressing and tick boxing approaches in corporates throughout, and hopefully through this way we can get better accountability and more clear understanding of the governance practices, you know, and the result of that, the outcomes that it achieves in organizations. So from that perspective, yes, probably it is an attempt to strengthen the reporting and the transparency in that regard.
The new disclosure framework, as I understand it, exposes weak governance. Which sectors do you expect to fail first and why?
I'm not expecting, I think, anyone to fail. I think what I'm expecting is better application of mind, hopefully, and organizations, when they really do, you know, undertake that exercise with an intent to do things properly themselves, finding the weaknesses, you know, and understanding where the gaps are. So I think it should be seen as a tool to enable organizations. It's not, for me, first and foremost, kind of a stick, you know, or some punishment that we're trying to dish out. I think it's really an attempt to also assist organization with application of mind to see where they can strengthen their practices.
What in this framework does better application of mind actually mean?
Because you have to now also indicate which of the practices you are not adopting. So in the past, it was a kind of apply the principles, explain how you're doing it. Now we're also asking organizations to be more transparent in specifically which of the practices, the recommended practices, they did not adopt, why they didn't adopt it, and why they believe it's not relevant or it's not value adding in their context. And even, you know, in the absence of those, that they are still comfortable that they are successfully, efficiently, effectively achieving the desired outcomes.
And Advocate, in that respect, double materiality, as I understand it, forces companies to assess their impact on society as well as the environment. And if we're talking about weakness, isn't this where most South African companies actually fail? And does King 5 now create maybe measurable consequences for ignoring impact?
I think, you know, that concept of the interdependence of that we need one another, and that we as corporates also have a responsibility to act as responsible corporate citizens. I think from that perspective, if you then look at impact, again, forcing companies to apply their minds to really consider, evaluate the impact, you know, of all the activities, their business model, their outputs on society, what the impact of that is, and to see to what extent they can actually, you know, improve or strengthen the good they do, and rather eradicate where possible, you know, the bad that's being done to society and the environment. Again, for me, Jeremy, it's really the intent is not to get companies to fail. It's really to assist in the application of mind to do things better in a more sustainable way and in the interest not only of the organization and shareholders, but all its stakeholders, including the environment.
Fundamentally, though, isn't the bigger problem voluntary governance, which we know has failed us? I look at Steinhoff, I look at many SOEs, I look at Tongaat. Why should the public believe that another voluntary model is suddenly going to hold executives accountable?
You know, Jeremy, I wrote an article a couple of years ago with the heading, "Is Corporate Governance Overrated in South Africa?" And I wrote that people were saying, "Oh, you're a member of the King Committee and you write an article like that." And I said, "Read my article." And it was in response to a comment made by a shareholder activist that Steinhoff is another example that the King report is of no use. And I was getting a little bit tired of the argument, because I was also saying, how many times must we still say, and I was then still a member of the King Committee, that we can write King reports till we blue in our face. In the absence of ethical and effective leaders in the corporate corridors and the corporate boardrooms, we will have more Steinhoffs and Tongaats. So one has to understand that King is a framework. It's the behavior of the leadership, of the controlling mind of these incapacitated legal persons that will determine the outcome. You know, so no King report is going to prevent that. We need human beings, you know, who are looking after the affairs of these legal persons to do it in a responsible, ethical, effective manner. And from that perspective, the King report is a tool. You know, and that's kind of the message I've been trying to give throughout. Mm. It's a tool.
Let me run at this argument from another direction then. As you've just said, King 5 leans heavily on ethical leadership. But again, as you've said, ethics has been a soft spot in South African business. Difficult, advocate, to force ethical behavior in a voluntary regime.
Yes, it is. But let me also tell you, you can't legislate morality. And there I'm quoting Prof. King. You know, we can have 100 more rules and laws on our books. If people want to be unethical, if they want to kind of, you know, run and govern businesses for their own interest, they will find ways to circumvent. They will find ways to window dress. You need individuals. And that's why we at Flirt Rock, you know, we say we get up every morning and do what we do and dress up and show, because we want to live in a society fueled by well-governed and ethical corporate citizens. And I kind of continue in my training with directors. I keep on spreading this gospel about ethics, about culture, about values. And I must be honest with you, sometimes I wonder, what am I achieving? Should I find a new career? And then tomorrow morning the sun shines again and I think about my grandchildren and what I will say to them one day about what I did to try and leave this world a better place for them as well. So we've just got to continue, you know, speak to people. I must also say to you, my experience in the 35 years that I've walked the trenches of corporate South Africa, the majority of people I've come across have been good, upstanding citizens. They want to leave organizations better off than they found it. However, there is a minority who's there with unethical, you know, their own moral compasses and their own ideas and agendas. And it's the weakness of the others that actually give the fertile ground for the unethical individuals among us to get away with what they're doing. So we need to educate ourselves. We need to apply our mind and make sure we understand how can we better govern our organizations to protect them and us from the unethical minority amongst us.
And a good place to leave the conversation. Advocate Annemarie van der Merwe, Executive Chair, Fluid Rock Governance Group. Thank you very much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, I don't need to tell you that South Africa's startup economy is brutally unequal. Access to capital, networks, and skills remain stacked against most would-be founders. But there's a growing view that AI, artificial intelligence, may be the first real equalizer that we've had in decades. Tools once reserved for big corporates, like design, coding, market analysis, automation, that kind of thing, suddenly available to anyone with data and, I guess, a bit of determination. And obviously, this has profound implications for entrepreneurship, for competitiveness, and broad economic inclusion. So let's discuss this in a little more detail. I'm in conversation now with Alex de Bruyn, Chief Executive Officer of Let's Create. He argues that AI isn't just a disruptor. It might be this country's most powerful engine for entrepreneurial freedom. Alex, welcome. This is a very important subject. You call AI an entrepreneurial equalizer, but isn't it also entrenching the power of the global tech giants who own the platforms?
Yeah, it is interesting. So we look at AI as two different layers. One, the actual model layer, which is the LLMs that are running. So we believe that's going to be commoditized, and they're being commoditized by the giants. But it's really what's that enabling on top of that. So we talk about the equalizer in the startup space. And what maybe just context, we specialize in B2B tech. So just with a frame of that, of how is it that it's unlocking our ability as South Africans or Africans to be able to compete globally. And our biggest aspect or biggest blocker in that part of it is that the amount of capital it used to take to get feedback of your idea and realize that it's a good idea and it's viable or not. So historically, us to get access to the market, access to capital, the world has a higher level of expectation what that technology at least has to do as a starting point, which it made that entry super, super high. what AI is allowing us to do is that we can shorten that feedback loop considerably. So we can, as entrepreneurs, we're ever optimists. And our biggest thing we need to do is we need to get punched in the face by the market as quick as possible. And how do you shorten that without losing as much or too much money? Now, AI allows us to do that because it's not really about the AI. It's not about the LLM. It's not about all of that. It's how you can use it to solve the problem that you think you're going to solve. And that allows you to then group what would have costed you from engineering to design to UI to UX, all of that together would cost you and take an immense amount of time to just validate your idea, to shorten that considerably and get something into the market, get something in front of a client and just validate your idea for yourself and for the market to then get to the next step.
So let me put this to you then. If, as you're suggesting, AI lowers the barriers so dramatically, why are we not already seeing a greater surge of new South African startups, or is it too early to call?
So I think publicly you're not probably seeing that, but at least us in the space, we are seeing an immense amount of surge in it. So I think what the market is realizing is that everyone's still looking at the big giants, everyone's looking at the brands, it's very known, and that takes an immense amount of time to build. In the B2B space, where we're dealing with non-public facing technologies, we're seeing an immense amount of surge in being able to solve specific problems. And what we're also seeing is that technologies, instead of going wide, so you have to build the next Uber or the next Facebook or the next HubSpot to be able to be successful, people are realizing that I can just solve one specific problem invisible to the world and be super successful about that. So people are niching down, which then doesn't get the public recognition. But we're seeing a lot of entrepreneurs kind of come through those ranks.
Alex, we do have, of course, a unique South African conundrum, though. Access is only equal if data and connectivity are equal. And we do have a fundamental problem of inequality in South Africa in that respect, do we not?
So, I mean, access to clients, I think that's the biggest problem. Access to the ability to have technology is becoming less and less of a problem. I mean, as long as you've got an internet connection, you can start creating, at least in our space. And that's widening considerably. I mean, there's a massive investments, not just in SA, but across the continent to make the connectivity to internet better. And that then unlocks the ability to create. Now, then there's two parts of it. So one, a global competitor doesn't have the localized knowledge of how to solve micro problems within an ecosystem. Where I believe individuals in those, even us as sitting in Johannesburg, solving enterprise problems, we lack the specific knowledge of a rural entrepreneur that knows the problems for their specific industry or area. And you compare that to the global player, they've got a massive advantage in terms of that. Because a lot of the large enterprises are trying to get into that space and they don't really know how. And technology is the one that unlocks that. The other access part is how do you now get access to distribution and clients, which is probably the bigger problem to solve, which now is becoming less of the technology and more of the access to demand. We're specifically trying to address that problem. How do we connect the clients that we have to entrepreneurs in areas that are very niched to do that? And I think that's where that moat and value is going to be of how do you connect those two.
What about the danger of, how can I put it, maybe early dependency? Is there a concern that AI tools can create shortcut entrepreneurs and they skip real skills and then suddenly hit a ceiling?
So I believe in entrepreneurship, the real skills only come from hitting that ceiling, right? Like you can theoretically study to be an entrepreneur and you won't know what you're doing on day one. The only way an entrepreneur is crafted is by trial and error. Now, I think the biggest risk that we have is that it takes too long to get to the error, where what this allows you to do is that you can very quickly hack something together, figure it out and learn those lessons without losing your shirt. And so I actually think it's bringing the ceiling lower, but then you can hit more of them quite quickly, which then crafts a better entrepreneur.
In your experience, Alex, what's the biggest misconception among South African entrepreneurs and obviously people that you've engaged with about what AI can actually do? Is there a huge gap of understanding here?
So I think the biggest gap, and there's two parts. Most of the AIs really just use at the moment for content creation and word generation and email sending. there's a lot of entrepreneurs that are now starting to get into technology building of it. And the whole thing about saying, you know, technology has the ability to create, or AI has the ability to create technology that is unstable, does not have bugs, does not have all the inefficiencies that we don't want technology. And the reality is humans do that as well. Humans get tired, they lack review, they don't concentrate. You know, they tend to create the same problems as AI would. And a lot of people look at AI as saying, we can't touch AI because it's not yet generating as good as a human would. But I think the misconception of that is that humans aren't actually creating technology that greatly in any way because of our, you know, we're overworked, we're overstressed, we're tired, we've got 10,000 things going on. We have the emotional impact of what that is where AI doesn't. And I think once people start realizing that, to say it's just another tool to empower you. Mm. It's not going to replace you. You need to use it to empower you and not be fearful of it.
Alex de Bruyn, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive Officer of Let's Create. I appreciate your time today. And on that note, we'll put a punctuation point on the show for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.